You're listening to CivCast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/CivCast. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to a new episode of CivCast. My name is Kyle, and I'm joined here today by my co-host, Dan. Hello, Dan.
Hello, hello, sir.
Welcome to the show. And if you missed last week's episode, then I would like to remind you that we have our returning new co-host, Valter. Valter, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kyle. Good to be back.
Good to have you here. So, yeah, if you missed last week's episode, Valter's been on our show a couple different times in the past. I think you did three or so guest spots before coming on board here. But go listen to last week's episode. That was episode number 23, titled, Dan, do you want to say the title if you remember it? It's the Australian thing. You want to say it?
No.
Okay, well, it's titled Digga after, you can just go listen to that and figure that out.
Digga.
Oh, okay.
There we go.
Facepalm. Where's my Picard gif when I need it? Okay, so guys, we've got a lot of cool stuff to get into this week. We talked about this at the end of last week's episode, that we have this surplus of awesome feedback from our listeners. We're going to get into that in just a minute here, but before we do that, Dan's going to lead us into the new CivCast challenge rolls. We took a little break week, which I think is totally fine. I actually really like that idea, Dan. It gives people time to, you know, just play their regular games, I think, in addition to the CivCast challenge. So what are we looking at this week here? Or month?
Absolutely. No, well, yeah, I think, we've moved it to a month. So it's definitely a month now. In terms of the actual challenge itself this time around, we thought after some discussion that we would streamline it a bit. And what that entails is giving you a chance to play Australia, the new Civ, and giving you a chance to maybe play them in a way that you haven't yet played them to this point. Certainly, I know that the three of us haven't tried this. And what that entails is a really straightforward and simple 1v1. Have you guys had a chance to kind of play just a basic kind of 1v1 in Civ 6 yet? Because I know I haven't.
I've not. Valter?
No, I never really got big into that. I think I did once or twice in Civ 5, but never in Civ 6, actually. I like the longer games.
That's a very interesting concept. Yeah. Never really even thought of it, but I think I've seen more of that being posted these days. Is that like catching on as a trend for people?
Well, I did see it in Reddit, and that is what kind of inspired this. I was going to do kind of a straightforward challenge with similar parameters to what we've had in the past, but I thought a 1v1 would be fun. And with Wouter's input, we've decided that we're going to do a 1v1. You're going to play Australia. The map that you're going to play is Pangaea, which, Wouter, I think you said is probably the most balanced and the smartest for a 1v1.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much the most balanced and the smartest for most things, mainly because the AI is still quite bad in the naval stuff.
That makes sense. Yeah. And everything else is going to be pretty standard. You know, your start position, your resources, all of that standard. I don't want to add too many conditions to this because I think it would be really fun to see some of the diverse games that people get. And the diversity is probably going to come in what Civ the AI gets. So I would highly encourage you to leave the AI Civ as random and see what you roll, see what the world gives you. Maybe you'll get someone who's a little bit more on the passive side, or maybe you'll get Gandhi, who knows. But, I think it would be really fun to just do a basic, straightforward 1v1 on Emperor difficulty on Pangaea map with everything standard and a random AI Civ. And just kind of see, see what approaches the different Civs take and kind of compare and contrast them. What we'll do is we'll take accounts of everyone who files their CivCast challenge results using the hashtag CivCast challenge, and we'll kind of compare it. So if you get Sumeria and Gilgamesh and these uber aggro, we'll compare that to maybe a more passive Civ like, I don't know, China is usually pretty passive in the Civs the games I play against them. So I figured it'd be a fun way to see how Australia stacks up against different types of Civs. Oh, and for victory type, it's any of the four victory types that you want. Take off time victory, because time victory is lame. Nobody likes time victory.
No.
Or not time victory, sorry, score victory.
That's it.
Yeah, take
it's
off
pretty
score
much
victory.
The same thing.
Yeah. So take off score, go with the four standard victory types and have fun with it and document it. And we'll kind of compare how Australia stacks up against some of the top tier and bottom tier cities in the game.
Excellent. As a quick interjection here, a quick thought, I want to say that Valter's taking over our Reddit efforts all around. So big applause for Valter doing that. So if you want to find it, that is our Civcast on Reddit. Nice and easy. You can find us very quickly. And so you're going to find Civcast Challenge notes up there. We'll be posting probably more of the winners and stuff. Valter, in a second, I'm just going to toss it to you if you want to maybe give us a little recap if you have any ideas of what you want to be posting and the type of conversations you want to see going forward. But also, while you formulate that little thought, I want to remind people that the Civcast Challenge notes are going to be up on the website. That's kyledempsterstudios.com/Civcast. So everything that Dan just said, you're going to be able to find it posted up there nicely for you. What else, guys? Let's see. That's it. Just remember to hashtag Civcast Challenge on Twitter when you post it. Valter.
Yeah, and it'll last for a month. Sorry, Kyle.
Oh, no, you're fine. You're fine. Valter, yeah. tell us about your Reddit ideas, if you have any yet.
So we've had this Reddit page for a while, and it is not being used that much. And I know you guys put in a lot of effort by sending us amazing messages, and I love that. But eventually we're going to come to the point, unfortunately, where we can't just talk about everything anymore. So I would also encourage you guys, if you want to have a longer discussions with us, or you have specific questions, maybe some strategy-related questions for me, or perhaps you want to comment on something that Dan said in his historical minute, ask some more over there. You can do those kinds of things very easily on our Reddit page, and I will be active over there and responding to your questions and dragging whoever needs to be there from these two guys also there. And I think that way we can interact with each other a lot more and a lot faster as well.
It just makes so much sense. Reddit's already a huge place for the Civ community. So being over there is just another awesome opportunity to connect with you guys. We, like Vader was saying, encourage you to post anything and everything you think is relevant to the show. On Twitter, we get a lot of nice notifications. People will tell us when things are on sale and such like that, like with the Humble Bundles and things like that. And so I'm sure that that's also a great place to post that kind of stuff as well. You know, like Vader's saying, if you have any strategy question type of stuff, like anything you want to know or anything you want us to talk about, post it there. That's going to be our new kind of hub to do that. I will still be monitoring Twitter all the time, so don't worry. No shame for tweeting at @Civ_cast. We'll still be pumping out our traditional content there as well. Without further ado, guys, let's look at what we got here because, again, awesome, awesome, awesome feedback. Want to start off by thanking our friend Custodian V131 on Twitter. He did very nicely retweeted our last episode, said nice discussion by the Civcast crew on Civ 6 Australia Summer Update. He said it's easy to give kind words when we make a good podcast. Thank you so much. That's very, aww, very nice. I love to highlight things like that because it does mean a lot. I mean, this is totally just a passion project. We just get together on Sundays and chat about Civ. So when you guys take the time to write stuff like that, it means a lot. Also, big thanks to Bernadette and Peter, who wrote in the past. They gave us some awesome things to talk about. And as you guys see, we try to spin the things that you write us into little topics for the show. So huge encouragement to keep that going. A lot of people are emailing civcastpodcast@gmail.com. That's wonderful. That gets right to me. The other option is going to our website. Again, I'll give that towards the end, but it's kyledempsterstudios.com/civcast. You can use that submission form at the bottom of the page. People seem to be liking that. I get the most feedback from that little submission form ever. So cool. Glad you guys are finding it useful. First thing,
it's a really nice place as well. Like the website is where everything of us is centralized. So yeah, people should go there.
Yes, thank you.
I personally enjoyed it a lot.
We also have Dan. Dan? Do you want to? We'll tease this towards the end, but there's going to be something up on the website you guys need to check out today. So keep your eyes on that. But let's keep rolling through here. Justin R. wrote in to say that he's catching up on episodes, and as I'm listening to you guys discuss claiming land and expanding the government system ideologies, he wanted to let us know that there's actually was a mod in Civ 5 where you could claim land. So this is back to our idea of kind of the spheres of influence. We were saying it would be nice if you could kind of peg out area on the map. And that way, if an AI or another person settled in it, it would be like public knowledge that you had wanted that land, and that by going there, that would be a huge, huge, huge issue. You guys are big Civ 5 players like myself. Did anyone try a mod like that? He couldn't think of the name, but it was... Yeah, he said he couldn't find the name for it, but it was out there, and it sounds pretty cool. Voucher, anything?
Unfortunately, I haven't had the opportunity to get that mod. I did look for it because I still have Civ 5 installed, and I still fire it up every now and then, but I couldn't find it either, so I'm actually quite curious. If you do manage to find it, please let us know.
Dan, anything from you? Were you a modder in Civ 5?
I was, but like I said, most of my mods were more on the aesthetic side or trying some of the fun civs that people had developed or made up. I never found or remember anything like this in terms of mods, but it does sound super interesting.
Yeah, I wish I could. That would be fun to try. It would be really cool if someone, maybe someone that's a modder will hear this and be interested in like kind of recreating it or retrofitting that to Civ 6. I don't know if it's super doable. We just got those new tools. A week and a half ago or something like that. So I'm sure I actually noticed over the weekend that there were a lot more mods in the store or in the workshop there. So it's coming. It's coming sooner than later, I think. He also tipped us off and said he remembers on Reddit, someone mentioned that perhaps Civ 3 had a system where as a democracy, you had to get congressional approval to declare war. This sounds familiar to me in reading up on the previous games. Were either of you Civ 3 players?
I think Civ 3 was the one where I got started. It's a long, long time ago, so I have to dig deep in my memories. But I think that's the one that got me hooked on the series.
I feel like if I remember correctly, and I could be confusing this with 4, so shoot me down if I'm wrong. But I want to say is Civ 3 was the one that had like expansive government types. Like you... I feel like I did remember reading a system where there was democracy, you had to get approval and stuff like that. I feel like that'd be fun. You would have to kind of combat with your own internals of the government just to get something done. Maybe that makes it too complex. Dan, do you have any thoughts on that maybe complexity issue too much?
Well, I mean, I started on Civ 4, so I don't know anything as it pertains to this. But the idea, as this guy suggests, that you have to get like something like congressional or parliamentary approval for war is kind of straddling the line between too complex and too deep and perfect. I don't know if I like it or not. Like, it would have to be a pretty like simple thing, like, oh, does Congress approve? Does Parliament approve? Yes or no? I wouldn't want to have to go through some whole like lobbying process for it or anything like that. But something like that sounds cool, and certainly would be something I'd be on board with in a comparatively simple format.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where I stand from the outsider perspective as well. Like, my fear would be if you overdo it, it would become its own game. You know, that sounds very much what's that new one? Urban Voucher, what's that? Do you remember that one? The urban planning game that just came out, or Dan?
Urban Empires, I
think. Yeah, that's it. That's it. I feel like it would almost be like that on its own. You know, you'd be like sitting there lobbying Congress, to your point, Dan. Like, you'd just be sitting there the whole game, like, okay, can I do this? So, Voucher, I come back to you. If Civ 3 was the game that got you hooked, I know we're drawing on your memories here, but was that something, anything that stands out that might have, you remember from that? Like, was that a hard thing? Does it sound too hard now after you've played, what, 3 new iterations of the game since then?
Well, I must admit that when I played Civ 3, I was really bad at the game. So it was quite hard. I was a bit younger as well, so I blame it on that. The main problem what I see with it is there has to be a mechanic in which you can influence the decision of your parliament to say yes or no to whatever you want to do, for example, declare war. And that sounds like a gameplay loop that doesn't sound that interesting. You are either micromanaging some kind of policies that you have to do, or I don't know, it just sounds like a lot of effort for a particular government type, because the other like two ideologies don't have a correct like counterpart to it, I should say, that I don't think it's going to work well in these iterations of the game.
Yeah, I think that's something where you know, you get so far along, you introduce all these different things over time, and then to keep introducing more really could get you know, to be over the top. I am feeling, maybe we can kind of segue this into to what we've been playing lately, but pardon me, but in the game I was playing the other day with my friend, we've been testing out the multiplayer feature, as I was kind of telling you guys last week, and we both played as Germany, which is cool because you can do duplicate leaders. We both played as Germany in this game over this weekend, and I really felt the lack of the World Congress and such in the game towards the end. I really am starting to miss that, and I know I've been hammering that in other episodes, but I just wish that we had some other way to influence city states and work with other governments and or I should say other leaders to just affect change in the world. Like, no one can put a limit on how many nukes I'm getting. No one can really punish me in any sort of way. And I guess I miss that punishment feature. You know, there's an awful civ in the game that you really don't like them for whatever reason. They're being very annoying. I always loved the ability in Civ 5 that you could embargo them so no one could trade with them. That's one of my favorite things to do, and we missed out on it. But I figure, yeah, let's jump into this now, guys. We probably all played a little bit of Australia, as we were talking about. Valter, do you want to start us off talking about one of your games? Anything that you've has come to boil to the surface for you?
So I finished, actually today, a game of Australia on Deity. I finally got a Deity win under me as Australia, and I just have to reiterate, they are amazing. I think they're my favorite Civ so far. Their production bonus when you get declared war upon is amazing. You just literally try to provoke the AI. So, hey, come at me and declare war so I can finish these spaceship parts a little bit faster.
That's a good point. Dan, anything from you in your latest game?
Yeah, I started an Australia game on an 8-person size map on continents, and I ended up on a continent all by myself, apropos of Australia. And it's fantastic. Like, there's a ton of barbarian camps, but there's 3 city-states on the continent, and I get unfettered, complete, solitary access to them. So they're my allies, and I'm just going with like an isolated science victory right now, and I'm pretty deep into it, and I'm humming along. I've got 6 cities all along the coast. I've got all the resources I need, and I've only met one other civ. I met Norway, and wow, there are supposed to be 8 civs in the game. So, I mean, I'm perfectly fine playing this kind of economic / production / science-based game right now, which I don't always like. I mean, usually the other civs add the flavor to it, and the AI adds a much-needed element of uncertainty to it. But I'm liking this, man. I got to say, I'm enjoying just kind of playing around with districts and adjacency bonuses and playing around with my placement. I find the adjacency bonuses with Australia are crazy if you plan things the right way.
They really seem to have a very good set for that. You know, one thing I'm not, I don't know, it's funny, when you launch an Australia game, the Sean Bean voiceover thing warns you that you are not a militaristic civ and you shouldn't be aggressive in your approach. And I hate to say it, but that's my approach. So I love them, though. They have such an interesting style, but unfortunately, I guess it doesn't always compliment me. I guess maybe I need to learn to provoke the AI more, to your point, Valter. Like, if I can get them to attack me, maybe I can start being a little bit more aggressive in my push. You guys have any thoughts on that one? What does a guy like me do?
Well, my first thought is that you shouldn't trust anything Sean Bean says, because you know he's just going to end up dead at the end of the game / movie / TV show anyway, right?
True.
Yeah, definitely.
So anything that really stands out, like when the pastor, what do they call Outback Stations? That's the new name for them. Those things are really, really cool, and I'm digging them. But I find that I had a really hard game the last time I played, where I had no resources around me to start. I had very, like, what seemed like raging barbarians, and I was barely able to, like, get to that point in the game that I had those Outback Stations. Have you guys had any, like, awesome experiences with those thus far?
They're literally a really good building, I think. They are usually, in my opinion, better than farms these days. So in all my tiles without special resources like rice or wheat, I place Outback Stations if I can. And if there's a pasture nearby, that makes them even better.
Let's see. What else do we have going on with Australia? The Diggers. Hello. The name of the episode. Any thoughts on those?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan. And just to the Outback Station point before, I was going to mention, The start bias for Australia really obviously heavily leans you towards desert. Mm-hmm. And so the one thing that that also allows for is for you to build Petra, which is one of my favorite wonders in the game. So coming out of my capital city, which is Canberra, I have Petra and I have a ton of outback stations. And really it's really cool. It's not like a unique style per se, but I mean, we talked last week about how we love the aesthetic and how it really just allows for you to have a really enjoyable, self-contained, resource-based game. And I'm just doubling down on all of these coastal wonders like Colossus and Great Lighthouse, and also anything that pertains to the desert, like the Pantheon for, what is it? There's a desert-based Pantheon. I can't remember what it's called and if it gives production or faith, but I loaded
it up. Folklore
and
it gives faith.
Thank you, Voucher. Yeah, I went with that one. I have all these outback stations. I have Petra. So I love not just their start bias, but I love the entire design and the way that Firaxis was able to manufacture this sim that has a really unique play style, has a really unique look to them. And yeah, the diggers themselves are really cool too. They look cool. I haven't experienced a fight with any of them because, like I said, I'm on a continental to myself, but I have built a couple and they are kind of just on, I guess, basic alert patrol around my island, and they look badass, and I'm assuming from their stats that they're super powerful.
And that makes sense. I mean, if you get attacked and they try and land troops on your place, those guys are going to be awesome, because as a reminder, they get that plus 10 combat strength when fighting on coastal tiles. So sticking them next to the edge of, you know, your continent there is going to be very, very beneficial. Has anyone, this is a good question, because I haven't seen this too much in Civ 6. It was a big thing for me in Civ 5, but in Civ 5, AIs used to try and invade my island a lot more. So if I was on like a continent like you were, Dan, I would always see these like hordes of knights and like all kinds of other, you know, units, crossbowmen, whatever, shoved into ships, and they'd be sending them across the ocean to come get me. In Civ 6, I haven't really had that happen yet. They seem to not only, you know, not be experts at naval combat, but they almost seem in a weird way to avoid it. Curious, Dan, are you going to, has anyone tried to move anything near you, or are they just leaving you alone? I guess you had Norway, right?
Yeah, and you would think Norway would be the one civ that you wouldn't want on your doorstep in a continents-based game where you're isolated because of their inherent bonuses coming from sea onto land. But he has sent exactly like two caravels, I think, buzzing by my harbors. I haven't seen him otherwise. And it is bizarre to me that I haven't seen any of the other six civs. And I'm, I think, industrial era at this point. Like, I'm deep into the game, deep enough to have Digas. Wow. And I just said Digga reflexively.
You did.
Good God. What is wrong with me?
Love it.
Apologies to all our Australian friends out there. But yeah, you know, it's weird because they haven't buzzed me with any kind of landing force. And it's just been one or two kind of exploratory, you know, caravels, like I said. So, yeah, Kyle, I think that the naval focus might not be there for the AI. I'm not sure, Wouter, have you had kind of similar experiences?
So I've played pretty much every map that there is right now, also including islands and everything like that. And I never really see them do a big naval thing. And I think that Firaxis perhaps recognized how bad they are at naval and therefore toned it down a lot. And that's why I recommend Pangea for a balanced game, because, well, otherwise the AI is going to have such a big handicap.
Wow. So you think to the point that, you know, instead of all, I'm not bashing you for access, but I'm just saying to summarize that, is that like, so you think that they're so, the AI is so bad at using naval units that Firaxis actually, while they're fixing it, is like, okay, just don't even try. You just shouldn't even look at that. Just stay on land. Stay where you're good.
Not necessarily don't try, but at least make it, don't spend all your resources in trying to do it.
Yeah.
And therefore it becomes quite rare, because it probably will happen every now and then, but it will probably be a rare occurrence.
So that's one of my favorite things, is when I would get that huge horde coming inland and you would just see it off the coast. Like I would strategically place like boats or submarines or whatever it was out there to have some, you know, eyes in the ocean, basically. Because some of my favorite games were like this fleet of maybe, I don't know, like 10 or so ships or, you know, 10 units just coming across the ocean all at once, a huge invasion force. And I just haven't seen that yet. So really hoping that gets fixed up, because that's just, I don't know, that's my style. I do enjoy a good naval game, but I miss that. I do want to share some weird glitches I found last night, and I posted one of these to Reddit. So my friend and I playing that multiplayer game, we ran into an issue where I had sent him about 150 gold per turn. And for some reason, the game weirdly decided to multiply that deal I sent him by three. So I had three 150 gold per turn deals happening at once. And it happened on a turn that was very clearly one I had not made that decision. Like, this wasn't a mistake. It wasn't me just being kind of forgetful in my approach. I went from having like an income of 400 gold per turn to two or something like that. Like, I was barely bringing in any money. My friend's like, wait, I'm bringing in 500 gold now? What's happening here? So it was very, very weird. Has anyone else had anything strange like that? Anything that's really off the wall? Valter, anything in your, you know, massive gameplay numbers?
So the only thing that I ever really noticed with me losing a lot of gold all of a sudden was when the AI sent a lot of spies to my commercial hubs to steal my money, because that will literally drag down your income per turn, but nothing like what you are describing.
Dan, anything from you?
No bugs on my end, no. I haven't tried to do any exploits or sought any of them out, though, so I don't know if that makes a difference, but nothing for me.
Believe me, I did not want to seek that one out. That was a real pain in my butt. Then I was making negative 72 gold per time. But Valter, you said something I really want to circle back to, which is, does that spying, when it says that they steal money from you, does it actually do that? Because I didn't think it did. I didn't notice a change in income.
Oh, yes, it does.
Really?
Yeah, you can literally go bankrupt from it. Wow. Which I have been close to a couple of times because the AI kept stealing away all my money from my commercial hubs.
I had no idea, but you know, I can't fairly judge because I forgot level two of the bug I just told you guys, which was, it turns out, even though it said I was sending all that money to my friend, and he was getting it, I was also still getting that money for some reason. So though it was saying, Kyle, you're making negative 72 gold per turn, my bank account was increasing by like 400 gold per turn or something like that. It was so weird. I took a picture because in the deal, like in that report that you can click on up at the top, it was only showing one deal. But if you hover over your gold in the top left bar there, it was showing the three duplicates. So I don't know what that was. But Valter, you and I talked off air yesterday when we were setting up and fixing some Discord things. I was telling you, I had a very weird layout of civs or of city states in that game. And Dan, you made me think of this point, saying that you were in the industrial era and hadn't really run into that many people. This is kind of tied to this. Not only did I have a situation, we were playing on Pangaea, so take that for what it is, but we have zero financial or mercantile city states in the game. Out of 18, there are zero that are focused on gold.
That's bizarre.
And annoying. So
I can imagine.
Yeah, I mean, we had 5 to 6 military focused and about 5 to 6 faith focused. I think we came in somewhere around like two science ones, and it was just a weird spread. I don't know what caused that. I mean, it's random number generation, I'm sure, but I really missed my Zanzibar and stuff like that. Where are you guys? Please come join me in the next game. Let's see. Any other standouts for you guys? Anything that you've come across that's really notable in one of your games?
Yeah, can I really quick? We have a quick discussion about the mechanic of appeal because yes. it's not a mechanic that we've necessarily talked about, and I haven't had a hell of a lot of games get super deep to the point where I'm pumping out neighborhoods. And so this game and my last game, I've had to really start dealing with the whole idea of appeal. And obviously that's a new mechanic, and it's one that I'm not, or at least prior to today, still not completely familiar with. So I hopped on the Fantastic Civilization wiki here, and I'm looking at appeal and seeing kind of the value it adds to your housing. And so to both you guys, and whoever wants to answer this first, do you, when you get deep into a game and you start placing neighborhoods, do you start paying a lot of attention to the appeal, or do you find that the housing bonuses it gives you don't necessarily help or matter?
I'm going to pass this to Valter.
So when you place your neighborhood, it all automatically shows you how much you will get from it. And I try to go for the highest number, which is the number with the highest appeal, and so that I get maximum housing out of the hammers that I put into it. But before that, I really don't spend like a lot of effort, like, oh, I have to keep this tile empty so that I can place a neighborhood there, mostly because neighborhoods that give you 4 housing are good enough, in my opinion.
That's a good point. I have to kind of agree with you. If I really don't go with anything lower than a 4, but I love that you brought this up, Dan, because you're jogging my memory. That's something I questioned last night. I had some areas with some very, very, very low appeal, and I actually couldn't figure out why. At first, I thought because one of them turned out to be very close to a uranium mine, and I thought, well, hey, that makes sense. You know, no one wants to live on top of uranium. Right. Turns out, though, my other city that has a uranium mine, perfectly fine. But those tiles on the other city were like -3 appeal. They're like, this is an awful place to live. So I was like, okay, we're not living there. But anyway, I don't really understand, and this is maybe just something we can talk about in more detail now or at a later point, but I don't understand what really goes into the game factoring that appeal in. Like, some of it's common sense. Like, if you're near an ocean, you tend to get appeal, just like in real life, people flock to the coasts. But then why is it that a very nice looking tile next to my city that doesn't seem to have too many issues, why does that go so bad? Why is it so low on appeal?
Well, gentlemen, I'm glad you asked, because the CivWikia tells me right here exactly what adds appeal and subtracts it. So you get +2. First of all, the biggest boost is you get +2 for an adjacent natural wonder. So if you put neighborhoods next to Crater Lake or whatever, you automatically get +2. Then you also get +1 for holy sites, theater districts, entertainment complexes, or wonders. Oh. You get +1 for mountains, coasts, woods, or oases. And you get +1 if the tile is on a river or lake. So those are all adjacency. Now you lose 1 for each adjacent industrial zone, encampment, airport, or spaceport. You lose 1 for each adjacent rainforest, marsh, or floodplain. And I guess the logic behind that is if you live by a rainforest, you might get like jaguars in your backyard or something. I don't know. And then you lose 1. Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. Malaria. No one likes that. Zika. And then you lose 1 for each adjacent pillaged tile, which makes sense. And I actually feel like that's not enough. If I built a house next to a piece of land that was on fire, I probably lose more than just a casual amount of 1 appeal. So those are kind of the things that break it down. And specific to Australia, those things all feed in really well to them. But doesn't Land Down Under have an appeal bonus built into it? Does anyone know that off the top of their head, Australia's unique Civ bonus?
Yeah, it does not.
I thought they got some sort of weird bonus to... we're going to look this up, I'm sure, but I'm going to let you be the definitive voice in that, Valter. I thought, they get +3 housing in coastal city. So I guess they just start with that and then yield
from... Yeah, the appeal isn't higher for them, but they utilize the appeal in a more efficient way for their couple of districts.
Yeah,
I'm looking at it right now. What it says is that the yields from campuses, commercial hubs, holy sites, and theater squares are +2 in tiles with charming appeal and +4 in tiles with breathtaking appeal. So that's kind of cool, because it affects your yields then if you have built it affects your yields depending on where you have placed those districts and the appeal. That so that's kind of a threefold interaction there, and that's kind of neat.
It is, and I like it. I have to admit, this really threw me off when I was doing the multiplayer game of Australia, because that was kind of silly of me to be playing multiplayer and learning Australia, probably not the best, because, you know, not as much margin for making mistakes. I can't just redo something if I really royally screw up in my learning. But I found it interesting because commercial hubs, for example, might get more adjacency bonuses from being away from a river than putting them on a river like you would traditionally do to get that +2. I thought that was very, very interesting, but at the same time, it really kind of screwed with my brain. I was like, wait, who takes precedence? What do I do? But I guess that's kind of the fun thing about making a unique Civ. You know, they should feel different each time, and already, you know, people's, you know, referencing good old Germany there, their Hansa gets different adjacency bonuses just because it is a Hansa, not an industrial zone. I guess that's fitting then, right, guys? I mean, seems like it.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think it's a really powerful ability as well, especially if you think about the Holy Site, for example. I believe that was one of the ones that got the appeal bonus as well. And
correct.
If you place it next to a natural wonder, then it just goes out of control because it gets plus for the natural wonder and plus for the high appeal. And then you can get holy sites that make 8 or 9 fate in the beginning of the game. And the same goes for campuses. I've had, I think the first district that I placed down was a campus with a +8 adjacency bonus. That's a lot of science in the beginning of the game.
That is an awful lot.
Yeah, it is. And if you look at the scale, so in order to get breathtaking, your appeal value must be 4 or more. And 4 doesn't seem like a whole heck of a lot. All you need to do is, you know, plop it next to a natural wonder, you automatically get +2 and then have some of these bonus, some of the adjacency districts that have the +1 bonus. And pretty soon you have not just the +6 housing that comes with it, but all the other perks that are involved there. So I bring it up because I think that the interactions pertaining to appeal aren't something that we've talked about. And they're not something that I personally understand a hell of a lot of. And so I thought it would be interesting to kind of delve into a bit. I'm curious if anyone out there in Radio Land has any feedback on the mechanic as to whether they like it or not, because I have to withhold my judgment on it. I haven't interacted with it enough to say whether or not I like it. I think it's neat and it has potential. I don't know what you guys think.
I'm digging it overall, I think. Like, you know, I'll kind of be the middle ground between you two and say, I'm liking it. I should definitely learn the mechanic better, as I clearly, you know, portray that I'm not versed on how that thing is calculated. But thus far, I mean, I solely use it with neighborhoods so far. I mean, whatever, I might change that going forward. But it works for me with neighborhoods. I try to plan that out a bit more. One thing that's, I don't know if it's fun or frustrating or somewhere in the middle, but it's an extra level. Like, once you get to the neighborhood portion, I try and keep in mind that I might have to rip up a farm to put a neighborhood there or some other tile, which is a good, it's kind of a game of like weighing your options. Like, is that farm actually being utilized? No. Okay. Well then perfect. And you can use that policy card that will give you, it's kind of a meager, I think 50 gold or something when you rip up a farm in place of a neighborhood. So I'm sure they know that that's probably the most common trend. Valter, any? Do you think that policy card is even worth it? Is that worth putting in for a one turn if you're going to rip up a farm? Is that worth that?
So it's only worth it, in my opinion, if you're going to rip up a farm and you have a policy that you're specific that you're researching, that it will be done within one turn, because that means the next turn you'll be able to get rid of it again. Mm-hmm. And even then, you have to look at, like, isn't there a better policy card that I can be using? For example, extra money from adjacency for commercial hubs. Most likely you have a lot of commercial hubs, and they have at least 2, maybe 4 adjacency bonuses. If you get that policy, maybe that will actually net you more than that 50 gold already. And it's not that awesome, especially because I really don't like replacing my farms with neighborhoods.
Well,
there are generally enough tiles available, even if I build my cities close enough to each other, that it can be built elsewhere. So why rip up a farm, even if you're not using it?
Well, because we were communists last night, and collectivization was key, and I ripped up a lot of things in place for stuff, Valter. So take that.
You're role-playing. That's role-playing. Also fun.
I took our Hearts of Iron little demo and put it to heart there. So I just ripped up a
But then
up
your
a
entire civilization should have been farms, Kyle. Come on now.
Well, we had the farms in their certain areas, but we had to build the apartment building so I could keep track of where my people were and pull them out of their beds in the middle of the night.
The stone mausoleums, that's right.
Yeah.
Soviet era mausoleums.
Yeah, it was that. It was actually very interesting. I kind of want to throw in two parting thoughts on my game. One, I didn't realize how awesome of a city-state Carthage is. Carthage, when you become the suzerain, for every encampment you have, you get +1 trade route. Talk about a huge bonus to that if you're late in the game, because as soon as I became their suzerain, I think my trade route cap immediately shot up by 5. And then for all the cities that I had originally been like, nah, they're not going to produce units, I was like, well, actually, that's going to give them +1 housing. That's going to give them the new trade route. So I was like, let's just keep popping down encampments everywhere. Maybe that kind of is why I started to run out of room. Valter, to your point, I actually was very short on space last night. I don't know if I did them too close together, but I was channeling you. Maybe I channeled you too much. I don't know.
Yeah, even when I built my cities, literally like the minimum distance that it is available to them, I rarely run into the problems like, oh, I don't have any space to put it. And maybe because I have not that amazingly high standards of what is a good spot to put the things down. But generally, I have zero problems getting good neighborhoods of 4 or 5.
I did also luck out in the Wonder Game last night. No one was competing for them, so I think I had like almost all the good ones. I had all the ones that give you a policy card slot, which, may I say, that is still my favorite Wonder mechanic that they have ever added to a Civ game, like including Beyond Earth, all that stuff. Like, giving me a policy card slot feels like the most tangible bonus ever. It just makes me happy because then I can throw a whole new policy in and a whole new bonus comes your way. Overpowered? Maybe. Actually, do you guys have thoughts on that? Is that overpowered to give us all these policy cards, or what do you think?
It's definitely good, but I wouldn't say overpowered.
Dan, any
thoughts? No, I like it. No, I mean, it's not overpowered to the point that it seems like something that can be game-breaking, and I think it's just a bonus for you focusing on that specific avenue, so I have no problem with it.
Good, good. Then you hear that for Axis? Do not nerf that. Give me more policy card slots, because, again, I just feel like I get the most bang for my buck out of it, and if anything, it really, anytime, actually, I will say it is the driving factor for me to get some of these wonders. If I see that I'm going to get a policy card out of it, I am there, Big Ben. You are my wonder. What are some other ones? There's the, am I saying that right? The
Forbidden Palace.
Yes, there you go. The Potala Palace. What's that one? I can't think of the name.
Potala Palace. And the Forbidden Palace is one of the best wonders in the game because it gives you that wildcard policy slot, mm-hmm. which is amazing.
That really is. And the Potala gives you diplomatic. Go ahead, Dan.
No, I was just going to say, you were talking about city-states, and a second ago, and I actually just jogged my memory. Can I give a quick shout-out to a city-state that I'd never encountered before, but which is extremely badass, and that's Hattusa. I got Hattusa on my home continent, and I looked it up, and its suzerain bonus is insane. It provides you with one copy of each strategic resource that you have revealed but do not own.
Whoa.
And for me, what that allows is just off the coast of my main kind of continental island, there are two strategic resources that are very stupidly placed on these tiny little islands that I don't want to go and build entirely new cities for. But just because I see them, I own them, and I had no idea that was there, and you jogged my memory when you were talking about city-states, and I got to give them a shout-out because that is a dope suzerain bonus, and I'm loving that.
Hey, Valter, do you have a favorite city-state you want to mention? Anything that comes to mind?
That's really difficult because it really depends on the game.
If you could choose, let's put it this way, if you kind of, as best you can, toss away what specific game, if you had to choose one city-state to then focus your game around, what suzerain bonus would you go for? Dan, I'll throw this one back at you too if that's not already your answer.
I forgot which one. I believe it is Geneva, which gives you +50% science if you're at peace. I mean, +50% science is awesome, so I'll take that.
That's the one. That's, you got it. Dan, was that your favorite, or did you have a different one?
Well, I'm surprised, first of all, that Valter didn't say Amsterdam. I mean, some Dutchman he is. Yeah.
What's their bonus? Oh, hey, I like Amsterdam. I had them, No, I didn't have them last night because there were no trade sieves, but this is your trade routes to foreign cities earn +1 gold for each luxury resource.
So it's pretty good, yeah. But for me, the best one's Stockholm. And Stockholm gives you +1 great person point of a district's type. So in other words, you get +1 extra great writer point or great artist point or great musician point for theater square districts and stuff like that. And so if you are heavily districted and you are the suzerain of Stockholm, you just chunk out great person points like no other. And you're going to be rolling out great people like, I don't know, 20th century America.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, you shouldn't look at that picture I sent last night, because as you'll notice, I might have conquered them and burnt their city to the ground. But that's for another day. Sorry, Stockholm. I asked this question and I don't even have an answer for myself. Boy, for me, it's probably going to be an industrial trade one. Carthage, though, actually, you know, I could really continue going with Carthage going forward. That each encampment giving you an extra trade route, that is so powerful. I didn't even know that was a thing. I don't know if I just never dealt with them before, but I might have to choose Carthage going forward if I had to choose any city-state.
Hey, doesn't Zanzibar give you, if you're suzerain of them, and I say doesn't as I scroll down to seeing it, so I'll just say, and I'll bury the lead. Zanzibar gives you their two unique luxury resources for being their suzerain, cinnamon and cloves. I don't think that you can get cinnamon and cloves on the map, can you? That sounds like a Beatles song.
Cinnamon
and cloves.
Nope. It doesn't exist on the map, indeed. It's a special one. It's
unique to them. That's your bonus. You get to reap the rewards of those amenities and trade some of them away. These guys are awesome. I think that this is such a cool way to expand the game. I really feel like city-states have taken they're getting way closer to like a front seat position instead of like riding in the back or even after the car this day. They're just becoming more and more important. They really have things that I just want to be ingrained in them because of their unique bonuses. They just feel worth, they feel like they're worth investing in my mind, but I do want that extra step that is like a World Congress that can somehow affect your placement. Like, I almost want to be able to send my spies to them to be able to remove other people's envoys or something like that. Like, I don't know. I want something else. I want to be able to go and deal with these city-states in a whole different way. I love the suzerain thing as it stands, though. I think it's a fantastic new implementation in this game.
But I don't believe that Firaxis already said, like, all right, it's not going to be in the game directly, but the World Congress will come back to the game.
I hope so. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that was in some of their early stuff, and I cannot wait. But I would love to see spies. I mean, I didn't really think about that until I just said it now, kind of fleshing that idea out. I would love it if your spies could take envoys out of those city-states. I just want another mechanic to be able to fight in what feels to me sometimes like a losing battle to control a city-state via suzerain bonus. Like, sometimes I just feel like I don't have enough points versus some other civs that come in there and, like, drop in like 8 to 15 envoys. I'm like, what? How did you do that? They'll just invest everything. Oh, but guys, we're getting a little bit short here on time. Dan, do you want to take us into a question, or I'm sorry, the Civ of the Week here leading up?
Sure. And I think that we've actually covered a lot of the Civ of the Week. It was just going to be more of a discussion on Australia and kind of our experiences with them and our interactions that we've had with other civs. So for me, I mean, as Wouter said, I love them. And I guess the question that I'd throw for you guys is kind of our Civ of the Week question would be, if you were constructing a tier list, so a deity tier list of what the potential power for each of these civs is, where would you put Australia on that tier list, God? Because I know, Wouter, you talked before about how the top of that tier list for you would be Germany. Does Australia pip that top spot from Germany, or are they like in the God tier but not quite there? What are your thoughts there?
It's a really difficult question because Germany is
good.
Really, really, really good. I think Australia is below Germany, but really close. It's really close, and I think why Australia is below is because it requires you to be a lot better at the game. Germany is relatively easy, also because they get that extra slot for a district in every city without having population for it. But if you're really good at the game and you know how to utilize the AI to your advantage, for example, let them declare war on you, then Australia can actually be better.
That's a good thought. As I said kind of earlier on, I'm thinking that for me, Germany fits as my top because they are more militaristic in their focus, and I maybe need to learn to play a little bit. I need to learn to play towards a different victory type, which is not something I do. I traditionally go my domination route. But boy, I don't know. There's something about Australia that feels so, so interesting. I don't know.
They're good.
Yeah.
Dan? That would be what's interesting about them. They're good. They're great. They're fantastic. And to me, it's just, it's the whole look of it. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I love just the orange and brown color palette that they use. And the fact that their Civ icon is a kangaroo, which has got to be the most stereotypical thing ever, and yet still extremely badass. I know I would have them at the top of my tier list. In my top, in like my God tier, I would probably have Australia and Germany duking it out. And then I'd have China sort of kind of below them, I guess, not quite at their level, but I really love China as a Civ as well. So that would kind of be my God tier.
China's fun. I like them a lot, to your point.
Yeah, for sure.
What's so also really nice on Australia is like their abilities. I feel they are really well fleshed out, better than some others, which feel kind of a bit generic. But Australia's abilities are really well fleshed out and really unique. That makes them also really interesting to play.
Can totally agree with that. They definitely feel unique and independent. And that's, I don't know, that's something that makes me, it's driving me to want to get in with them a little bit further and play them more.
Yeah, absolutely. And my historical minute for today actually has nothing to do with Australia. It's completely different. But I don't know if you wanted to read a bit more of this feedback here, Kyle, before we morph into that.
You know what? I have one more I'm going to read towards the end of the show. Let's go ahead and drop this one right now. I'm only going to do a bit, then we're going to save more for next week. That way we're keeping it different. But Matt Vogel wrote in. He said that he's loving the podcast, make a nice product. And he said, do you think in an upcoming episode you could cover other civs and strategies and what would make for a doable domination wins. He says he typically wins at science on prince level, but I seem to get bogged down when I go to a war. I just feel so inefficient. What civs and tips would you suggest to make me more successful in this victory? So I could toss this guy. We're short on time to go into any sort of discussion on this, but Matt, how about you write in, tell us who you've been playing. If you're playing someone that's actually focused towards a science win, or are you playing someone that's a kind of, you know, in the middle? Are you playing someone that can do both? But the other thing I wanted to tack on, this goes back to our initial statement, is in this show, we tackle more news and general topics. So what we're going to do is, for any strategy things, that's what's going to find a home on our Reddit page. Now, if we see something that's awesome over there that we can go in depth on, we can bring that strategy onto the show if it seems like a good fit. But for now, we're kind of going to leave the strategy to a more text-based thing, just for the, you know, efficiency of time and all of that. Also, it can be a bit difficult to, I think, discuss some levels of strategy when it's just kind of spoken word, especially because if we say something that might be a little bit more, not even complex, but something good to reference, it's a little bit harder to just go back in the podcast to do it. So Matt, how about you send us another email? Tell us who you've been playing with Civ-wise when you're doing those science games, and feel free to make a post over on the Reddit page. Let us know your thoughts there, and we'll try and tackle those. But Dan, that's what kind of where I'm going to leave it for this week. We'll get to our other pieces of feedback next. Tell us what your historical minute is.
Well, I have to give him another Peter the Great kind of anecdote. And this is a really quick one. Now, of course, those of you who've been listening know that Russian history is my focus. And Peter the Great is one of, in my opinion, the greatest, God, I need a thesaurus sometimes, greatest leaders of all time. And certainly he is the leader who modernized Russia. But did you know that on Peter the Great's Grand Embassy, which is, of course, the trip that he took to Europe in order to, with his large Russian delegation, in order to meet with many of the Western European nations, including the British and the French, and also Wouter, the Dutch, that Peter adopted an entirely different moniker. So when he was traveling across Europe with this Russian delegation, he instructed the delegation to refer to him as Peter Mikhailov and to refer to him as a carpenter, a Russian carpenter that they were bringing along on the trip to learn the shipbuilding kind of practices and the best shipbuilding processes of some of these countries. And this was, of course, roughly an 18-month journey before he was forced back to St. Petersburg. I think it was actually back to Moscow initially to deal with the rebellion that was taking place. But Peter actually studied shipbuilding in a ship carpenter's yard in Amsterdam, and he studied under the tutelage of some of the best shipbuilders belonging to the Dutch East India Company. So Russia is not exactly known as a naval power, and that makes sense because, I mean, their ocean ports didn't really exist until he captured the Azov. But Peter was so determined to turn Russia into this modern industrial power that he thought that a strong navy was necessary. And so what did he do in order to learn the best kind of shipbuilding practices? Well, he didn't just send, you know, a group of professional carpenters along to Britain or to Holland to learn. He himself went there and studied shipbuilding under the tutelage of the Dutch East India Company. And he took the lessons that he learned back to Russia, and he took them to his court, and they managed to build an enormous Russian navy on the Azov, and they used that newfangled Russian navy to defeat the Turks and capture the warm water port of the Azov. So I guess to summarize this historical minute, Wouter, the Russians owe your people a great debt because it is the tutelage of your shipbuilders and carpenters that taught Peter the Great how to build better ships and in turn help the Russians conquer a large part of the southwestern part of their empire.
Aww.
So bravo.
If you ever want to repay that debt, I am completely willing to give my bank account so they can give me a large sum of money.
Or vodka, right?
Or vodka, that's also fine.
Questioning that you're going to give them your bank account information.
Yeah, the Russians, not ask.
They probably have it already anyway.
Yes, so to all of our Russian listeners. You just write in and let us know your thoughts on that one. Okay, guys, we did it. We tackled a kind of random episode of a lot of different feedback and things like that. But I think we need one of these every once in a while to just chit-chat about everything, especially after coming off a week of big patch notes and things like that. I love tackling those big patch notes and new sieves, but it's always good to just get our highlight some of our awesome listeners who are taking the time to get in touch with us. So again, you know, if you want to talk strategy, let's do it over on the Reddit page. That's just our Civcast. And anything that's awesome there, we're going to pull into the show. So, Matt, you need to send us what your sieve was there, and we'll try and help you a little bit more with strategy. And then let's see. So anything else we need to tackle this week? Oh, I want to get to that question of the week I had from a while back. There was an awesome straw poll. We're probably going to save this to next week. Not super. Actually, it's easy enough to tackle now. Not super, super surprising. But that straw poll that circulated on Reddit asking what difficulty people play, the results wound up being a pretty even break between people playing King, Prince, and Emperor, each of those coming in at about 26%, 25%, and 22%. So Pete, seems like people are actually gravitating right to the middle, as one would expect. Chieftain, very bottom of the list, so it seems like people are very much challenging themselves with the game. Until next week, everyone, it's going to be, you're going to see us over on Reddit now and on Twitter. So I already gave you the Reddit. That's our Civcast. Twitter is @Civ_cast. I'm over there @KyleDempster7. Dan is there @DanTheMax. And we've got Wouter over there @Innocentius69, right? I need to write this in the show.
Yeah,
notes.
That's correct.
Why do I keep, I told you this the other day, I keep forgetting that you have the 69 on some of them and not. My bad. You can send us any emails that you might have to civcastpodcast@gmail.com. Share this show with your friends. Tell them that you know some random guys that like to sit together and talk Civ 6 and all of its different ins and outs, quirks, and different things. If you guys found any weird bugs like I had, feel free to share those too, because those are always fun to chat about. Everything you need to subscribe to the show is @KyleDempsterStudios.com/Civcast. We've got our Patreon page. That is patreon.com/Civcast. So we'll talk about, you know, it all being on the same page there. And you can also find a link to that on the main website. I'm going to be posting something up there a little bit interesting today. I'm just going to do a little audio clip for our loyal listeners, get them a little update on the state of the network and all kinds of things. And I think Wouter, myself, we chatted about this yesterday. Dan, we're going to put our heads together, you included, and kind of rework some of those tiers on the Patreon page. Just put all of our thoughts together and see what really stands out. If you, the listener, want to write in and tell us what you find value in when you're subscribing to someone everyone's Patreon, please do let us know. It's always good to get some more ideas and to really hear what people want out of it, because anything you donate goes to help fund our podcast hosting and website. So you're just facilitating us getting it, you know, further out there on the internet. And it's very, very helpful. So anything given is super, super appreciated. What's the last thing? Oh, Dan, do you want to maybe talk a little bit about a show that you could be working on today that's going to appear on the website?
All right, guys, 30 seconds. Go to your podcast tab. If it's in the middle of the week, you should be able to find it and search up the letters RP and then the word gold. So what we've put together, Kyle and I have put our heads together and we've come up with a new podcast concept and a little bit of a look behind the curtain. I'm kind of old, guys. I remember the days of Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis. And in fact, I had both of those systems. And so what we have done is we've put together a new show. It's called RP Gold, which stands for Role-Playing Gold. And the idea behind it is that we are going to approximately every 2 weeks highlight and discuss RPGs, whether it's a Japanese RPG or Western RPG, MMORPGs like World of Warcraft or whatever, RPGs from that era, about 1993 to 2006, the Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis era, all the way through to PlayStation 2 and Xbox. And we're going to go really in depth on one game every show. So we're going to pick a game through user feedback or through what we've been playing on Steam or through emulators. And we're going to go really deep into those games and talk about how those games, like what their legacy is, how they stand up today, and kind of like the influence, the tendrils that came out from that game into modern gaming. And so the first game that we're going to be highlighting should be no surprise to you, because probably the most popular RPG series of all time is Final Fantasy. And the first game that we're going to be highlighting on the show that we are filming today is going to be the best of all the Final Fantasies, which is the Super NES classic Final Fantasy VI. So if you love old school gaming, if you love old school RPGs of all kinds, check out RP Gold. We are on Twitter at RP Gold Podcast, and you can find the info on the website. I think, Kyle, that it's all up there on the Kyle Dempster Studios website now.
It is. So that's kyledempsterstudios.com/RP Gold. So as a reminder, everyone, that's just one word, RPGOLD. We'll get you there.
Yeah. So give it a listen, folks. I appreciate every single ear that that downloads it and that listens to it. We're hoping that this is a concept that we can roll out kind of in concert with Civcast. We love giving you guys content and we love diversifying the content. So this is an entirely new show, an entirely new passion project. And we hope you enjoy it.
Yes, I'm sure everyone is going to love it, Dan. And it looks very nice. It's up there on the site. You guys can go click around, find some info on that. We're going to go step out here and record that in just a few minutes. So until next time, everyone, just one more turn. You're listening to the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. For more shows like this, visit kyledempsterstudios.com.